The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and on this week's podcast, we tackle three hot potato topics currently ricocheting around the technology world, and we discover that we're actually in the future. Already. Yes, Charles Arthur reports back from last week's Consumer Electronics Show. Now, last week, Michael Gove, the school secretary, revealed his plans to rehaul the UK's ICT curriculum. But are his plans realistic? Google found itself in a mire with a Kenyan web service when it was revealed that some of its employees had been picking through its African rival's business database. Has this Samson and Delilah battle shaken the Do No Evil foundations and Google's famous motto? And it's the US's turn to tackle the upheaval that the digital economy is thrusting upon big business. The controversial SOPA and PIPA legislations are currently being debated in the congressional system. What effect will these acts have on the rest of the world's access to the web if the Western world's giant starts to muck around with the pipes under the hood? Joining me to debate these stories is Matt Bryan, head of news at The Next Web. Matt, welcome
to
the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Dan Catt, Guardian developer extraordinaire. Welcome, Dan.
Hello.
Well, thank you both for coming. I'm curious about a curiosity, or at least your interpretations of a curiosity that emerged this week. The ever-innovative Swedes have decided to coalesce their national identity underneath one Twitter feed. Which they will offer or they will farm out to an individual for a week at a time. I think that's a fantastic idea. I mean, here in this country, we've had the fourth plinth, which isn't too dissimilar, except obviously a little bit more local. Matt, who do you think would be the most representative person to take over the 140 characters for the UK?
Tough question. I think you could probably say someone like Kate Winslet.
She's terribly posh.
Well, you could. She plays all of these quite dowdy characters, but she seems to have her head screwed on.
Absolutely. Dan, Kate Winslet, yeah, an interesting but potentially middle-of-the-road choice. Who would you say is the most ridiculous person to take over?
I quite like, I'm not sure if it's English, is the horse ebook account at the moment, which is on Twitter. No, there's this bot on Twitter that's trying to sell ebooks, and it just randomly takes little sentences out of it and tweets them, and they're like these little wonderful, lovely, beautiful phrases that make no sense whatsoever. But I think it's American. I'm not sure if it's British. If it was British, I'd have it. Eddie Izzard, I'd like to see. Because he does quite a lot of visual stuff. I think that would be quite absurd to have on Twitter.
Well, if you've got an idea of who you think would represent the UK, let us know. And perhaps we shall do something about it, but probably not. So keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. The internet is under threat, according to opponents of the Stop Online Piracy Act, a bill that is currently being debated in the U.S.'s House of Representatives. Now, according to John Naughton in this week's Observer, it proposes a law that would allow the U.S. government to create blacklists of websites that should be removed from search engine indices, and thus essentially censoring them. The bill also opens doors for lawsuits by companies who feel that their copyright is being infringed. Now, Matt, we've had the Digital Economy Act in this country, and the Australians have had their great firewall. How is this attempt at censoring the web any different?
I don't think it is any different, but coming from the US, they like to stick all of their new bills under some really catchy names. And all this is really doing is... And it's not really that well thought through. The Act itself, it basically allows the legislators to restrict access to certain websites by modifying their DNS entries.
And DNS entries, tell me a little bit about how those work.
Well, basically, it's if you put in theguardian.co.uk, for example, that is then translated to an IP address, which is a fixed address that will correspond to the server that website is then hosted on.
Okay.
So if someone wanted to change that, they'd be able to change the DNS setting, and that would either be able to block the route that takes it to the IP address, or it would just make sure that never actually gets you to the Guardian website.
So it will still exist, but you won't be able to find it unless you type in 168 point blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and basically you'd be able to access that website without having to know the website address. So there are parts of it that are quite fundamentally flawed, and there are people already that are creating plugins and extensions for browsers, for mobile apps and stuff like that, that allow you to circumvent that blockage before it's even been put into place.
Dan, why should we notice here in the UK?
Well, I think one of the problems is that what they're doing is they're targeting web services that happen in other countries as well. So if someone in America decides that a web server over in China or Sweden is serving their content, then they want to have that knocked off the internet for people in America. But because when we look things up in DNS, we'll sometimes point to Google's DNS and other things, that's effectively knocking it off for us as well. But there's also the payment part of it. So if I run a website not in the US, where I'm just linking to copyrighted content, or maybe that content isn't copyrighted in my country, but it is copyrighted in America. So America then opposes to it and then says, MasterCard, Visa, you can't take payments for that website. Then it's affecting me here in the UK because I can no longer get to that website or pay for a service. So even if the things aren't copyrighted, we have different copyright terms, not in the UK, but in other countries. So you're doing something perfectly legitimate in France or Finland, America can say, you're stealing our content, and they'll just knock it off the web.
The way that I see it, and I don't know if you agree, is all that the legislators have to do in the US is maybe flag something. And then that then raises the issue of, should this content be blocked? Well, in the US, if you don't even have to be operating in the US. You might use a US server. You might have services that are specifically aimed at US users. But you're not actually based in the US yourself. If there's just the one question that you're maybe serving copyrighted content, or you're doing something that's slightly illegal that goes against the acts that they're trying to pass, it can affect your service without you actually doing anything wrong in the first place. So there are certain things in place that are suggesting that at the moment they could have their sites knocked offline or routes to their sites taken away.
I've got a variety of tumblers, right? The one that I write for The Guardian is untanglingtheweb.tumblr.com, which is for the column in The Observer. If somebody on Tumblr serves or delivers or provides copyrighted content, regardless of whether it's, you know, my site, it's under the Tumblr domain, how would that affect my Tumblr?
If you have content up on Tumblr, and there's an accusation that some of it's copyrighted, then the notice can be served against Tumblr to immediately take down your content. And they have to do that to protect themselves under the law from, you know, greater penalties. And if they don't do that, then they can be blacklisted and the whole of Tumblr goes off the internet.
The entire Tumblr, regardless of the fact that I've done
exactly.
No wrong.
So Tumblr, so if you put something up and I just go, hey, that's mine, it's copyrighted, you've got 5 days to defend yourself, which is not enough time to do it. And Tumblr are just going to turn you off straight away, even if I just made it up. So you're going to have all of that sort of trolling and so on and so forth.
It's an extension of what actually currently happens at the moment. If you look at BitTorrent sites, they are sometimes taken down by federal agencies. And, you know, their sites are taken. They have a notice put on the front page. But they are contacted beforehand. They're asked to stop infringing copyright. Basically, this act is going to take that one step further and start putting like a deadline on these people. And as we were just talking there, it gives them that warning. But if it's Tumblr doesn't directly infringe its users, so it's getting into that part, you know, that thing with their users where they're having to work out, okay, do we take this off and risk and appease the copyright holders, or do we not? Risk getting our sites taken offline.
Now, you mentioned, Matt, that there are already people who are creating widgets and apps and services that go around this. Surely pirates and various other clever people will be able to circumvent these restrictions.
Of course. I mean, if you look at the way that file sharing has evolved over the years, services pop up and they show different ways of downloading content. With this day and age, you have apps that can help you deliver content that is served in another country or via different servers. You have these extensions that allow you to basically go down to the base level of how the internet works and allow you to circumvent the way that DNS is pointing you to a website. So pirates are always one step ahead of the game. They will work out another way to be able to circumvent any blocks put in their way. So I imagine it's going to be like a cat and mouse game. With the legislators always one step behind.
Dan, we've talked about some of the downsides of this, and we've talked about what the opponents would say, but what are the proponents saying? Why has this actually got to where it is? Is it a similar case as with the Digital Economy Act, where the people in charge don't really understand and they're being delivered information that, you know, makes it sound compelling? Or are there, you know, is there a really grounded reason why this act and its sister act, the PIPA Act, have got this far in Congress?
I think it's one of those things where you look at some of the wording used about it, and it actually kind of makes sense. So I'm looking at the SOPA Act, and it's saying that if there was a website that hosted nothing but movies, then we should be able to knock it off the internet. And that kind of makes sense. And you think that if people just stuck by that, then that everything would be okay. It's where this gray area that if you could trust the big media organizations not to do crazy mad stuff, then it would seem to work, but then you see them all the time doing this type of thing. But what's happened is you have the millions of pounds of lobbying from the media industry that's putting it up to the Senate. And then you have all the people viewing it with the being lobbied, saying, this is a good idea. We need this to underpin the American economy and all of these type of things. But at the same time, the Senate has been refusing to sort of see the other side of the argument. So you've got all these professors and these lawyers saying, this is a really bad thing. And the Senate's going, oh, la, la, we don't need to hear this. You know, that's all internet-y type of stuff. You know, when you look at it on paper, stopping piracy, that's a brilliant idea. We should certainly do that. Don't bother me with the technical details. And that's the bit where I think people are worried. I'm pretty sure that most people don't want copyright infringement kicking around. But it's the implementation, and it's the Senate's understanding of it.
It's interesting to note, though, that I was reading yesterday that the complaints had got to a point where they've shelved the plans for it. The opposition seems to have had an effect, both from Obama and from the website and technology websites themselves, because they've shelved SOPA for the time being. It doesn't mean it's gone, but I think now the interest is now moved forward to PIPA to try and take that one down again.
Well, it's the opponents. Team certainly has some heavy hitters. I understand that Wikipedia will be going down this week in protest, as well as other sites. Now, of course, keep your browsers on guardian.co.uk/technology for the latest. The UK's Information and Communication Technologies, or ICT, curriculum has been slapped around quite a lot lately. Everyone from the Royal Society to Google have had a pop at the way UK schools have faltered in engaging pupils with the joys and the excitement of becoming computer developers. Now, last week, Schools Secretary Michael Gove announced a total rehaul of the ICT curriculum in a way that he hopes will encourage more pupils to take computer and engineering courses and become part of the UK's innovative technology workforce. Matt, what was Gove's announcement?
Basically, he announced that he was going to kind of shelve the ICT curriculum that they were teaching in schools currently and move it more towards a computer science, teaching children how to learn how computers work, teach them the fundamentals of programming, and allow them to be able to be one step ahead or understand how computers work, so that when they leave school, go to college, go to university, they're able to understand how the devices work without having to find out them for themselves. And they can innovate instead of just following the trends.
There is, I think what's been interesting is the responses that people have had, or, you know, the stats that have come out about, you know, the number of people who've got to university level and then dropped out because they simply don't have the skills. They're not prepared for it. And I wonder, Dan, you know, the current ICT curriculum has been put into place with all the best intentions, but somehow it's fallen over. What form do you think that Gove's intentions are going to take in the end?
I remember being at school and spending most of my lunch times playing Revs and Elite on the computer, and I think that helped quite a lot. The interesting thing in computers in those, I'm going to sound old now, the computers in those days, you could play games on them and on exactly the same one. You could then program yourself, so you could do it. But that's actually true of computers nowadays. So people are saying we need to have these devices that people play on games consoles. They consume it, but they don't actually get to interact with it. But anyone who has a computer can fire up JavaScript and code on it. So I think
I mean, I can't. I could, but I can't.
I know, but you could. But even when I was at school, they didn't teach you your programming. They just gave you a machine and let you play on it. So in those days, they were interesting because they're new. And I think the problem is that when you're showing people spreadsheets and Word documents, the beige box is no longer interesting and fascinating. And you have to re-engage the pupils with, you can bend this to your will and make it do things for you, instead of you're just going to sit in an office and punch numbers into it all the time. So it's that re-engaging the fascination with computers.
Matt, is the problem Steve Jobs, the Appleification of the stuff that, you know, is now firmly under the hood, the widgetization of programming, of putting things together?
I disagree with that. I think Steve Jobs has helped, and Apple and, you know, Google with Android, they've helped bring these easily to use tablet computers and iPhones to the mass market. And what that's done is that's shown people that there's different applications that can do different things. And just because you can see a film on an iPad doesn't necessarily mean that you can't download an app that can teach you how to do something. So basically, his vision is to bring a technology to people's fingertips that not only shows you that you can do certain things on the move, but you can now create that same app or do something. And you think, well, that app can do exactly what I want it to, but it doesn't do this. I would love to be able to create my own app, release that on the App Store, and then make more money than that developer is. And I think that's what's happened. You can see that apps have boomed over the last 2 years. There's now, between Google and Apple, there's over 1 million apps between the two app stores. So people are seeing that there's massive amounts of opportunity on the App Store. And they're going on to Objective-C. And basically, they're learning the tools that can help do Hello World apps on their smartphone. So I wouldn't say necessarily that Steve Jobs has broken that down. It's maybe the failings of the educational system that have shown that to be able to get a job when you leave school, you have to be able to use a Word document and an Excel spreadsheet. Granted, you might have to. But there's so much more. You know, when I was in college, we learned Pascal. When I was a young boy, I taught myself HTML and JavaScript and built a website. And I taught myself. That wasn't from school. School was actually something that was quite boring. And I imagine that's the same for a lot of kids these days.
For more on digital literacy, you can check out The Guardian's digital literacy campaign at guardian.co.uk/education. Google was in hot water this week as it emerged that some of its employees had allegedly, illicitly hacked into a Kenyan-based business directory, Mocality, and were systematically using the information that they gathered, allegedly, to target sales of their own Kenyan-based service. Matt, what happened?
The story here centres, obviously, on Mocality, which is Kenya's largest business directory. And they had done all the hard work of incentivizing users to submit businesses to its listings by using Kenya's insanely popular mobile payment system, M-Pesa. And they would transfer small amounts of money to users to incentivize them to build the listings. And I think they had 170,000, maybe more, listings on there. And last year, before Christmas, Mocality noticed that there were some of their business partners were getting calls asking them about free websites. Mocality doesn't offer free websites and only just offers listings. So they were thinking, well, there's something off here. So they thought that maybe there was a bot or a service that was scraping some of their data and then feeding that to a call center that would then follow up a call and ask these business owners if they wanted a website. Well, it turns out that the website offering was coming from Google. And the access to the site was coming from Google's servers.
Where is the case now? Do we know, you know, has Google said anything? Have they said sorry? Have they said no, nothing to do with us?
Google has said they're mortified by the whole thing. They're very terribly sorry and they're going to look into it, which is what Google tends to do. Like, this is whole thing about, is it Google or is it an agency who kind of work for Google? And where does the line separate? Because it's quite the number of people who called the call center, there was a lot of them. And it's a whole big group of people. So it obviously is a team who are doing this. And the question is kind of, how far up the Google chain did this go? Who in Google knew and authorized this? And where the cutting off point? And why didn't Google know about it? So even though Google have put their hands up and said, oh, it's one of our people over there, we're really, really sorry about it, that is all they've said. And whether they'll ever come forward with, we've investigated, we've got rid of this, and whether it changes their behaviour and how they deal with other people that they hire, would be interesting to see. So it kind of leaves questions hanging.
Following on from that, it's quite interesting that in the wording that Nelson Matos, the Vice President for Product and Engineering at Google, he actually said that we were mortified to learn that a team of people working on a Google project. So, for example, he's not necessarily saying that it was Google directly, but then what happened later down the line in the sting, Google recognized that when they were calling the number, they were probably getting something that they weren't expecting. So they changed where the visitors were accessing from, and the IP address that time then resolved to Mountain View, California. There are reports that it was a third party working on behalf of Google, because it was then outsourced to an Indian call center. But we want to know, really.
All signs point, don't they?
Yeah, we want to know. Someone at Google must have known what was happening.
Well, you can catch up with the rest of this week's news at guardian.co.uk/technology. The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur, was traipsing around beautiful Las Vegas last week in pursuit of the future at the Consumer Electronics Show. Well, he's found it. 3D printing. Is it the end of capitalism as we know it? Will the proletariat, empowered by their own means of production, overthrow the elites and take over the world? Or is it just a cool gadget? I imagine the truth is somewhere in between. Charles Arthur investigates, and he also talks about a few other cool things from CES that may or may not take over the world.
I'm Bree Pettis, CEO of MakerBot Industries.
So explain to us what MakerBot is and what your aims are with it.
MakerBot is a machine that can make you almost anything you need. And you basically can either design something or download it from our site, thingiverse.com, and then print it out and make it real.
It's a $2,000 kit, and it's sort of about the size of a large bread maker, which extrudes plastic, and you can make shapes of pretty much everything. We got chess sets, pliers, little statuettes. You've got a globe there, you've got a cube there. What are the limitations, if any, on what it can make?
This is like 2.5 times our last machine. So we really ramped it up. People wanted big, so we went, okay, you can make big things. And then we also put two extruders on it. So you can make things in two colors. So I'm holding a globe, and the water is blue, and the land is green, and you can make things in two colors, which is exciting. The other thing that's big deal for us is, up until now, we've been kind of a Heathkit-style company, where you order and you put it together. With the MakerBot Replicator, our latest model, you get it and it comes, and it's minimal assembly. You just snap on the extruder and you're good to go. We're entering a new market, the consumer market, and this means that more people are going to have access to the means of production and be able to turn their ideas into real things.
How much does, the plastic for one of those chess pieces, how much does that cost, roughly?
You know, it's 4 cents a cubic centimeter, and we bundled in the electricity to make it into that figure as well. So, and those are hollow, so you're probably looking at maybe 1 or 2 cubic centimeters, so maximum 10 cents per chess piece, maybe more like 5. We'd have to wait to know exactly how much plastic is in there.
And it's made of a biodegradable material, is that right?
Yeah, we have a material called polylactic acid, or PLA, that's made from corn, and when you're sick of your objects, you can put them in your compost pile. We also have a more traditional ABS plastic, which is what Lego is made of, which is really colorful.
I understand one of the people who's used the MakerBot has designed a Lego piece that Lego don't make.
There's a program that you just say, instead of a 2x4 kind of regular Lego piece, you can make like a 3x17, which doesn't exist. So for younger kids, there's Duplo blocks. And if you have Duplo blocks, you very probably have a Brio set. And a Brio set is the train set. Well, a user on Thingiverse, where we share the site where we share our designs, made a connector so you can connect your Duplos to your Brios. Now, neither of those companies would make a piece that would connect their system to another system, but because MakerBots enable you to make anything you need, you can do that.
So that was Bree Pettis of MakerBot, and now I'm going to head over to a company called 3D Systems, which has a completely different business model, although it's doing just the same sort of thing, 3D printing.
I'm Rajiv Kulkarni. I'm the VP and General Manager of the Consumer Solutions business at 3D Systems.
Okay. So you have a 3D printer. Just explain to us what sort of materials it needs and how much it costs.
Right. So what we are launching today is Cube, the first 3D printer for the home. It is designed to be used by kids, moms, and the family together in the living room. What Cube is part of is a larger platform called cubify.com, where we have a lot of templates of printable files uploaded by artists for sale. And then we have software engineers who upload apps which help to tweak, personalize, and customize 3D models, which are then used by the kids to print files onto the Cube.
How much does each one of these cost?
It costs $1,299. That's the retail price for each of the unit.
Uh-huh. And the plastics, I assume it works with plastics, does it?
Right. So it comes with a cartridge, which is about $50, and it can print about 5.5-inch cube. And one cartridge can print about 10 or 11 of those average-sized parts. So each part is about $4 or $5 each.
So I'm here with Mary Loblad from Intel to talk about ultrabooks. Mary, what exactly defines an ultrabook?
Well, an ultrabook is a term that Intel trademarked in June of 2010. And if you're looking for a laptop that is 13 inches or below, our specification for ultrabook is 18 millimeters thick. And if it's a 14-inch and above, it's 21 millimeters thick. And obviously, when you get down to those thin designs, light designs, the weight also goes very, very low.
Are there specifications as to the sort of hard drive in it? Does it have to be solid-state drive, or can you have rotating drives?
You can actually have two different scenarios. You can do solid-state drive, and so what we're seeing is up to 256 gigabyte solid-state drives. We're also seeing something called a hybrid drive, which is interesting. And so typically what you'll see there is up to 64 gigabyte solid-state drive for data caching. And then you'll have an additional 500 gigabyte hard disk drive for your storage. And what the SSD allows is the snappiness. So when you put the computer to sleep or you shut the lid, you open the lid back up, you're going to get back to your applications in less than 2 seconds.
There's dozens of them on show here, and more are expected. Is this sort of going to flood the notebook market in the way that netbooks did a couple of years ago?
I think that's what we're going to see. As you can see here at the show, we've got all of the makers jumping into the market. They're all trying to make them a little bit different. So stylish is one of the big buzzwords you hear around ultrabooks. You'll see different colors, you'll see different textures, different types of metals, different types of metal alloys. And a lot of that is not only stylish, but actually performs a function. Because these are so thin, you have to be able to dissipate the heat inside of them. And even though they're running ultra-low voltage processors, they don't necessarily have internal fans like you would typically see on a larger laptop.
Do you have to sacrifice processor speed for this? I mean, netbooks are all on Atoms, and they were a bit pokey when it came to processing.
Ultrabooks are on Intel Core, just like laptops. The Intel Core used in ultrabooks can be a Core i3, i5, i7, but what sets them apart is their ultra-low voltage, so the wattage is lower, and they dissipate less heat.
So a bright and light future for the ultrabook, you think?
We hope so.
Jessica Ching of the XPRIZE Foundation, who have launched the Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE. Jessica, explain to us what this is aiming to do.
It will actually bring medical diagnoses directly to you as a consumer in a way that you, the consumer, deem is usable and desirable.
So the tricorder was the thing that they used in Star Trek to be able to diagnose what was wrong with people without actually touching them. Do you think that the prizes in this will be of the same order? Do you think they'll be able to do it from across a room?
I believe that's going to be a big part of the competition. We leave that open to teams, but a key component of this prize, we believe, is going to be wireless sensing, which through wireless sensing, you'll be able to pick up metrics about human health through non-invasive sensors. The great thing about this prize is the ultimate determinants about whether that's acceptable or not will be consumers themselves. Consumer usability is a key component of the prize that the teams will need to meet. So we don't specify whether the sensors need to be wireless or not wireless. invasive or non-invasive, but obviously from a consumer's perspective, you can imagine which preference they may have.
The idea is that there'll be something that, people can use themselves. You've named 15 diseases and conditions that these have to be able to diagnose. Just tell us what a few of those are and how difficult they are to diagnose at the moment.
Strep throat, conditions that are common, such as sleep apnea, or conditions that are costly, such as colon cancer. And those three are all diseases from the set that the teams will compete.
And when is this going to be awarded?
There will be a qualifying round in 2 years, a final round a little after 3 years, and at that point, the best team will be awarded the prize.
So that's CES over for another year. It's been an interesting sort of year, not very thrilling on the Microsoft front because they haven't had anything to announce. Windows 8 is still far in the future for them. It's probably going to be coming in October. Nokia made a comeback in the US, at least, with the launch of its 900. It'll be interesting to see whether that makes any real impact in the market. It won the Best of Show award on the Thursday, but some people then pointed out that the Best of Show award the year before was won by the Motorola Zoom, which, as tablets go, has really vanished. It's hardly made a ripple in the overall market. And it has to be said that this year, tablets weren't really very obvious. There's not been a great deal of interest around the tablets, even though it seems like every stand that you walked at had someone or other with an iPad. Ultrabooks were the interesting thing, and the Intel stand was very busy with people looking at the dozens of models that they had on show. But the real story was about smart TV. It seemed like every manufacturer who had a TV set, including some of the Chinese companies that you've probably never heard of, was offering smart TV with connections to the internet and often their own app store of some sort. Although all of them seem to have Angry Birds. That's the one constant between all these things. Smart TV looks like it's going to get real traction this year. Almost all of the TV sets that you'll be seeing in the shops will have some sort of smart TV functionality built into them. The question is going to be how easy they are to use and how well they'll work with services in the UK such as iPlayer and ITV Catch-Up. As for 3D, which is the other great white hope, that doesn't seem to be catching on. Smart TV, though, especially in the US where the TV is full of adverts, really looks like a good alternative if you can go to the internet and find things you want to watch. So, Microsoft, not much to show. Intel, plenty to show. And smart TV, definitely the one to watch for the year ahead.
That was Charles at CES. The one to watch, he says. Well, actually, Matt, I'm curious about what you found interesting that came out of CES this year.
I thought CES was, as Charles said, I think it was last week, he said that there was going to be not that great this year, maybe. And I kind of had that same feeling. From what I saw a lot of like-for-like Android devices. I saw a race to see how thin TVs could go, both LG and Samsung releasing very thin TVs. And there was also a real rise of devices that were waterproof. I saw also a lot of rappers trying to release headphones. That seems to be the new currency. Instead of releasing maybe apps or something like that, they will now release a brand of headphones to compete with the Beats by Dr. Dre. 50 Cent now has his own, and Ludacris now has his own.
Dan, what did you see?
Lots of internet-enabled TVs. Not necessarily that people want them. It's just that you're going to buy one. If you buy a TV, it's going to have internet.
Ah, well, I expect to see more of headphones on TVs that are connected to the internet in the future. For more coverage of CES, head to guardian.co.uk/technology. Anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. Many thanks to our studio guests, Matt and Dan. Next week, Charles is back from a visit to Finland with the goods from inside Nokia HQ. This week's podcast was produced by Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratosky. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.